of a cigar. The little rocket sparkled to life, soaring out of its resting place and high above the Titanic, exploding into a star of bright light.
"How many more of these do we have on board?" Smith asked his man.
"About half a dozen, sir. Didn't really ever expect to get a chance to use them on this ship."
"Yes," the captain agreed.
His eyes remained on the rocket's twinkle as it died in the night sky.
"Captain?"
Smith remembered Kott's presence.
"I'm sorry, Mr. Kott. You must forgive this old sea dog. I've had a few things on my mind."
"Understandable, sir," Kott agreed.
The man proceeded to write in his little book. Smith looked on with curiosity.
"What are you doing, man?"
"Something mentioned by the doctor,"
Kott explained, never looking up from his writing.
"I'm writing the facts down while they're fresh in my head."
"What the devil are you talking about?"
Kott spotted a genuinely perplexed look coming from the captain. The episode was startling enough to cause the detective to drop his pencil.
"Why, the murders, of course."
"Oh, that."
"Yes, that," Kott repeated. "I have other things on my mind, Inspector. I don't need to hear your facts."
"Don't need to hear my facts?"
"The Titanic is going to founder, sir."
The detective bent down to pick up his pencil. Kott's hand froze in midair, hearing the news. He slowly brought his eyes up to meet the captain's careworn gaze. The detective's face was one of disbelief.
"What? From that little bump?"
"That little bump, sir," said the captain, "punched more holes in our hull than in a block of Swiss cheese."
Kott thought long and hard about the situation he found himself in. This was no way to begin a retirement.
"What of the murderer?"
Frustrated, Smith started to pace up the wing toward the ship's bridge. Stopping midway, he turned, looking back toward Kott's. Caught between the urge to yell at the man or laugh, Smith felt pure admiration toward Kott's sense of duty.
"Providence has seen to the justice of the murderer, Mr. Kott's. She, along with his vessel, will find their resting places."
Smith paused.
"However, if you should survive, I give you my permission to further our business once you reach the American shores."
Kott's gave the captain's suggestion some thought. The detective closed his notepad, placing it back into his vest pocket.
"Who would believe me, sir?" Kott said. "Who would think that the unsinkable Titanic had fallen prey to a 3,000-year-old mummy?"
"Well said," Smith proclaimed.
The men watched as the sailor launched another rocket. The silver plume of the rocket's explosion once again cast its shadow on the Titanic's decks. Several gasps of surprise could be heard coming from the lower decks as passengers started to cheer the fireworks.
"Will anyone notice these?" Kott asked, pointing to the little explosions.
Smith squinted upward at the distress signal shining above him, waiting until the silvery shimmer of the blast died away before he answered.
"I have been given reports of a ship not 10 miles away from our bow."
"Any contact by wireless?"
Smith shook his head.
"No."
A sailor nearby helpfully added,
"No reply. As far as we know, the ship probably doesn't have a wireless device. The contraption is still new. If she has wireless, not every ship is equipped to handle a 24-hour watch."
The young man's face showed the futility he felt regarding the situation.
"Begging your pardon, sir," the sailor replied, coughing. "I think the bastard's sleeping."
Smith looked out over the ocean, peering into the cold night to spy for any signs of a signal. He thought he could see, if his eyes weren't playing tricks on him, a tiny glint of a ship's light at the tip of the sea's horizon. 12:40 a.m. William Murdoch walked down the port promenade, studying the faces of the passengers as he walked by. He was in a terrible position, and he knew it. The first officer knew that of the 2,000 passengers on board, there would only be enough room for 1,000, maybe 1,100, if every lifeboat were filled to capacity. It was time to pick who would live and who would die.
"If there is a ship out there, somewhere, let it get here in time,"
he thought, uncovering a lifeboat.
"For as God is my judge, if I have to start choosing, I will not survive this account."
"Mr. Murdoch."
The first officer turned to look into Ismay's worried eyes. The company chairman surprised Murdoch. He was under the impression that the captain relieved Ismay of his influence on board ship.
Mr. Ismay.
Murdoch was doing his best to hold back the expressions of dread.
You're not to bother us, sir. I am under orders. Now please, be a good sport and step out of the way.
Ismay's eyes flashed with hurt. He was mad, knowing there was nothing he could do to stop the Titanic's death.
I want to help,
Ismay pleaded. The man was shaking like a frightened child.
Please, Mr. Murdoch, let me do something.
The first officer stood silent, perplexed.
Oh, I know that I'm just going to regret this,
he started to say.
Wonderful.
Ismay clapped his hands together, genuinely happy that he could be of service.
Yeah, it's marvelous,
Murdoch grunted.
If the captain asks, you tell him that this was your idea. Now come and follow me, sir. We're getting ready to load lifeboat number 7.
Sure, 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 Ismay guaranteed.
Anything you say, number 1. What are you doing, Will?
Murdoch said to himself.
This man's going to spend most of his time getting in my way. Stop this mistake before you regret it.
Ismay ushered himself down the deck, pushing passengers out of his way. The man was gathering up any free hand he could find. Remarkably, Ismay's management skills were working.
Everyone remain calm, Ismay pleaded to all within earshot. Everything is under control. Please stay with your families and do as you are instructed. You've got to give the little bugger credit,
Murdoch marveled.
He seems to know what he is doing.
Murdoch started to select passengers, readying them for immediate evacuation. C Deck, Third Class Promenade. Kare stopped to gaze into the sorry brown eyes of a little child. The girl was no older than 7 summers, and although others were screaming with horror at the sight of her, this little one appeared to be unaffected.
Brave little child, do you understand?
Kare silently prayed. Kare brushed the girl's hair with her hand and noticed a young woman screaming out her daughter's name. A ship's steward held the terrified mother back, looking on in fear.
Rachel! Come here, Annie! Come to your mama!
Confused, Rachel clutched her small china doll with all her childish might. She gazed up at Kare, and then back at her yelling mother. The child didn't know which command to follow.
Stay with me, Rachel.
Kare silently pleaded, almost ordering.
Let me feel the joys of motherhood. Motherhood was robbed from me once by the one I loved. Come, child, kiss your mother.
Kare pointed to her dry lips. Rachel, like any child given a chance to express what older people found challenging, rallied at an opportunity to show the love that was inside of her.
Kiss me, child, and I shall promise to save you.
Rachel kissed Kare. The mummy heard gasps of disgust rising from the ranks of the onlooking passengers who were starting to regain their courage.
Come on, lads, someone yelled to the crowd. Let's kill the monster. Save the child.
Rachel, wiping the dust off her mouth, gave Kare a sorry glance that touched her heart. Rachel held out her china doll. Kare was startled to see that the youngster was offering her most valuable possession as a gift of friendship.
Bless you, child. For your kindness.
Kare took the doll. Several men started to step forward, carrying pipes and other objects that were not nailed down. One gentleman, Kare noticed, kicked apart a wooden bench, handing out clubs to any who were interested. Kare held up a silent hand, stopping the fight.
Do not step any closer. I warn you.
Kare beckoned. Although not able to speak, her message seemed to get through. Kare praised her gods, for they were on her side.
At the appointed time, I will hold the ship sinking, giving you a chance at life. This child's love has saved what future any of you might have.
Kare opened her mouth, trying to speak the words. All she managed was a hollow moan. At first, the men started to charge her, swinging their weapons as they advanced. Kare grabbed the first two and threw them overboard. As the angry mob heard the screams of the flying men, then the icy splash of their bodies hitting the Atlantic, the steam went out of their fight. Slowly, one by one, each returned to his family's circle, consoling frightened wives. Kyle Ray spotted a blinking light from the corner of her eye. The mummy released Rachel, allowing her to return to her mother's crying comforts. No longer interested in the child, Kare focused on the blinking light far out on the sea. It was a curious thing to her, blinking with a rhythm she found threatening. It was a code. Someone was trying to make contact. Kare raised her arms, praying to the gods of the underworld.
Great Anubis, grant me the power to shield this ship from her kind. Prepare for me a wall in which to hide the Titanic. Grant me this, Anubis, and I promise you my service for all eternity.
Warmth surrounded the Titanic.
I promise you, great Anubis, lots of blood. Souls by the hundreds shall be yours for the taking. Indeed, the gods of Egypt are great gods. They shall take action for those who have mocked them.
The shocked passengers of the Titanic watched as a London-like fog gathered around their ship. If there were a ship out on the horizon, it would never spot the rescue rockets nor see the Morse lamp. There would be no rescue. Bridge, 12:45 a.m. Andrews was studying the technical specs on the Titanic's compartmentalization. He was going to try a crazy idea to save the ship. All he had to do was convince the captain that it could work. Time was against him, however, at last check. The Atlantic's waters were coming close to drinking in the ship's bow. If the bow were to sink under, the plan would not work.
Yes, Andrews shouted as he grabbed a set of wire cutters and some electrical plans. It's possible.
There was a rotten pang in his stomach that seemed to eat away at him like an ulcer. If Andrews didn't try to make amends, there would be no way he could allow himself to survive. The plan he had was simple.
I have to go tell the captain, Andrews said. Dennis, I've got it.
To the shipbuilder's surprise, his friend was nowhere to be found. Parker left the bridge without Andrews' knowledge. Why he would leave without excusing himself confused Andrews. It was not in Parker's nature to be rude.
God, I hope he hasn't gone and done something foolish, Andrews nervously said. Americans have a tendency to blow everything out of proportion.
Before leaving, Andrews put on a warm jacket he had worn just hours before to a friendly dinner party. He started to realize that although the party was a boring one, it was possibly the last one he would ever attend. Andrews saw a drastic change in the ship's forward tilt. It was deeper and was growing in intensity.
Crap! He yelled, looking at his watch.
It had been almost an hour since the Titanic first encountered the iceberg.
There isn't enough time.
Andrews knew that there would be no way of explaining to the captain what had to be done. He proceeded without a blessing.
All that's needed is to find an assistant, Andrews said, unrolling one of his blueprints.
A-Deck, Ship's Gymnasium, 12:47 a.m.
You sure you're not married?
Molly Brown asked Kotz as he tried for the fourth time to exit the gymnasium.
Mrs. Brown, I do believe that they have given the call for the boats to be lowered. Shall I help you into one?
Molly found Kotz standing outside the ship's gymnasium doing what he could to help calm the nervous or the frantic. The ship seemed sound to him, and it did seem impossible that something as huge as the Titanic could have been the victim of an oversized ice cube. Mrs. Brown had been a pleasant diversion.
I'll find a boat. Don't you worry, Reggie.
Reggie? Kotz hated the nickname.
Reginald, Mrs. Brown, the detective corrected. You cannot pick and choose here, miss. Please let me help you.
Impressed with Kotz's concern, Molly peaked with happiness. She was touched.
All right, she agreed. It's all a waste of time. We'll be back on board by morning.
You are a stubborn woman, Kotz laughed. Are all American girls like you?
Nope, Molly beamed. I'm in a class all by myself.
To be sure.
Both left the gymnasium to walk out on the deck. Molly stopped, giving Kotz a curious stare.
Is something wrong, Molly?
Kotz asked, paying close attention to her look of confusion.
Call me crazy, Molly laughed. It feels as if the deck's tilting forward.
Molly's smile started to fade.
Which boats did you say were going to be lowered first? Kotz shoved through the growing crowd, trying to help his friend to the lines where passengers were being lowered into the lifeboats. Kids were starting to cry, having been awakened early, and the scent of breakfast began to permeate the air. Funny, the detective thought. The ship's sinking, and the cooks are still making loaves of bread for tomorrow's breakfast. Kotz had a chance to see Thomas Andrew walking his way. Andrews started to show signs of stress. Kotz noticed a pale complexion about the shipbuilder. "Mr. Andrews," Kotz yelled, waving his derby in the air so that the Irishman could see him. "Thomas, over here." Andrews stopped looking at his electrical plans and gave the passengers a scan. The shipbuilder saw Kotz's derby, following it down to spot the detective's familiar face. "Mr. Kotz, have you seen Dennis?" Andrews yelled. He was being pushed back by a wave of second-class passengers who had been given clearance to arrive on the promenade. "No," Kotz insisted. Molly Brown turned from a friend, tapping Kotz on the shoulder. "I spoke to Dennis not more than 10 minutes ago. Was there something you wanted to tell him?" "Where did he go?" Kotz inquired. "I don't know, really," Molly said, thinking. "Kept repeating that the whole thing was his fault and that he was going to do something about it." Molly giggled. "Really, he was nothing but worry." "Oh, dear," Kotz said, thinking the worst. "Have you seen Dennis?" Andrews repeated. "Mrs. Brown here states that she spoke to Mr. Parker about 10 minutes ago." "Sure did," Molly suggested. "Mrs. Brown," Andrews insisted, "you need to find your way to a boat." "Everybody keeps saying that." Frustrated, Molly huffed away, disappearing into the panic-stricken crowd. Kotz, amused by Molly's wrath, started to laugh. "One of the most fascinating women I have ever laid these tired eyes on. Next to the French, these Americans are fantastic." "Never mind that right now," Andrews said. "I need your help if you don't mind breaking standing orders." Kotz, surprised at Andrews' ominous tone, studied the young man with curiosity. What was he up to? "If a man is going to create treason, what better time than the hour of his death?" Kotz said. "I'm your man." "Outstanding." Andrews patted Kotz on the back, handing the man a set of wire cutters. "We're going to the power room." The men headed for the nearest elevator. "Thomas," Kotz asked, "you say that this is being done against the captain's orders."
"I thought that you were with me."
"Oh, I am, son, I am." Kotz raised his hands, showing complete acceptance on what the shipbuilder planned. "It just seems rather odd." Andrews nodded, understanding.
"I haven't the time to explain."
Andrews directed the detective to a nearby elevator opening its small lift's gate. "If the water reaches the anchor wells, we're dead."
"Why?"
Kotz followed Andrews into the elevator. "Aren't we sinking anyway?"
"The anchor wells are above the watertight compartments. With them flooded, the Titanic will sink faster, possibly ripping the ship in two."
Andrews shook his head, thinking.
"I just knew that I designed the first-class dining saloon with too few supports. If she breaks, it will be there."
The elevator descended. The men headed to the power room, where they were surprised to see that it was occupied.
"Mr. Andrews, is that you, sir?"
Engineer Joseph Bell greeted the two with a firm handshake.
"Joe?"
Andrews asked, questioning. "Shouldn't your men be getting ready to leave the ship?"
"Captain's asked for people to keep the lights lit. We're going to do our part till the end."
Alfred White, the ship's electrician, had his hands full with a tray of tea.
"Good evening, Mr. Andrews," White said, placing the tray of tea on a nearby wooden table.
The room was barely lit due to the strain on the ship's power.
"Care for a spot of tea?"
"Perhaps later."
"What can we do for you, sir?" asked Bell, drinking his tea.
"Is there a way to open the watertight doors from this location?"
White laughed. "You should know, sir."
Andrews opened up his electrical plans, laying them on the wooden table next to the tea.
"We need to open the watertight doors," Andrews explained.
"What are you talking about?" Bell inquired, concerned. "If you open the watertight doors, we'll sink."
"Joe."
Andrews smiled, taking a red pencil from his pocket.
"We are going to sink anyway. If I am to die, I'd rather choose the method of my destruction than leave it to chance."
The shipbuilder started to outline his plan, drawing out mathematical calculations.
"Death is one thing," Kotz pointed out. "Is it within your right to take all these souls with you? I believe you to be a noble man, Mr. Andrews.
Calm my fears, son, and tell me that you're doing right here.
If it all works, Mr. Kotz, I plan to save as many lives as I possibly can.
How so?
White poured some tea, peering at the plans Andrews had been figuring out. It is my understanding, taking into account the rate of water accumulation on the ship's first 5 compartments, that if we open the watertight doors, we could delay our foundering. If we wait another 30 minutes, it won't make any difference.
Andrews paused, showing White his calculations.
Opening these doors will allow the water to run its course through the ship and will keep the Titanic on an even keel. If we keep doing the way we are, the stern will be wiggling in the sky, and that will do nobody any good.
The purpose of this?
The engineer's face brightened with a smile.
The pumps? Andrews suggested.
What?
Asked White, still confused.
Of course!
Bell jumped, understanding Andrews' plan immediately.
Can't you see, White?
White could not.
The ship's most powerful pumps are located near the aft of the ship, Andrews explained. They will do no good if they are in the air.
Will it work? Kotz asked.
Andrews, Bell, and White stood puzzled. Kotz could see that each was looking for some sort of reassurance from the other.
It should work.
Definitely.
Possibly,
Andrews concluded, rolling up his plans. Bell, wishing to take the lead, led the 4 men from the ship's power room to one of the many fuse boxes.
This is the one you're looking for, Tom.
Studying his plans, Andrews nodded his approval.
Constructed for this purpose, I believe.
That's correct, sir, White agreed.
Due to the growing tension between Germany and the British Crown, certain military aspects had been requested in the advent of war. The juncture was placed here in case the bridge lost control of the emergency panels.
I was totally against them, Andrews made sure to protest. The Titanic is a passenger ship, not a battleship.
Bell mused.
Could you imagine her importance? Possibly as a troop transport or a hospital ship.
Andrews stopped his work.
It's all irrelevant. In less than 3 hours, she'll be sitting on the bottom of the Atlantic.
True, Kotz added. It's a damn shame.
It took several minutes to rewire all the connections leading to the watertight doors. Kotz realized that his mission was to hold the electrical plans as Andrews and his team went over them. He was told to hold a loose wire, but other than that, his assistance was of the most elementary.
There we are, Andrews proclaimed.
His face beaming with pride, the shipbuilder took out his watch, looking at it.
In record time, if I do say so myself. Shall I flip the circuit breakers, Mr. Andrews?
White asked, reaching for the switches.
The shipbuilder shook his head.
No. I think that honor should be given to our detective friend.
Kotz's eyes widened with surprise.
Go on, Mr. Kotz. If it hadn't been for you, I'd never have finished this.
I didn't do anything, Kotz insisted.
Didn't you know?
Andrews questioned. Andrews gestured at Kotz to give the breakers a flip.
Nothing happened.
Oh, hell!
Andrews yelled, dragging out his plans again.
Why didn't it work?
White asked.
We should be here in the compartments opening by now.
Damn it!
Andrews cried.
The main junctures have been severed. That bitch of an iceberg did more damage than I first thought possible. Damn me for not seeing it sooner.
If this isn't going to work...
Kotz's voice had a film of worry in it. The ship's decks were becoming increasingly difficult to stand on.
Then that means... That means whoever is going to get here better do so within the hour.
Frustrated, Andrews threw his wire cutter on the floor. Orlop Deck, Fireman's Passage, near First Class Baggage, 12:50 a.m. The port cargo hold was the only place in the Titanic's bow that had not yet flooded. Somehow an air bubble had been created, giving whatever cargo secured there an added lease on life. Parker was fighting with his guilt. He was to blame for this disaster, and he knew it. Ka Ray had to be confronted.
Why all these deaths? He asked himself. Hasn't there been enough killing? Weren't the lives you took in Egypt or England enough for you? Why now? Why this vessel? Is it because she is the vanity of our age? Or is it because I am on her?
He found his way in time to Ka Ray's open coffin. Parker could feel the water rising. He could hear the creaking of the ship's iron. He splashed into water up to his waist. So overcome with the events of the last few days, he cared not for his personal safety. All that mattered was Ka Ray.
Come out of your coffin, Parker screamed as he approached the sarcophagus. Face me!
The sarcophagus, though ancient, still contained the dependability given to it by its original creators. As the water rose, so did she, floating better than the Titanic. Parker tore off the lid, failing to notice the damage he was causing. So old was the wood that it brutally splintered off in his hands. Pieces of the ancient cover continued to float.
Where are you? He yelled. Haven't you the courage to come out? It is I, the man who interrupted your bloody nap.
Parker's eyes came into contact with those of Sahisha's, his old adversary. Ka Ray placed him back into her coffin, a final tribute to Sahisha's greed. Bloated, Sahisha's skin was a dark blue, his face containing the last traces of life, frozen in a scream. Salt water had been slowly seeping into the wooden box, splashing onto the dead Egyptian's face.
You should have taken her, Parker screamed, pounding his fists into Sahisha's ribcage. The two of you would have made a perfect couple. Your evils would be unmatched.
Parker's hands crashed through the dead man's flesh, entering his body. The flesh was soft. The stench hit his nose.
My God, what am I doing?
Disgusted to the point of vomiting, Parker withdrew his bloodied hands from Sahisha's chest. Black blood, thick as butter, dripped off his fingers. Parker could see the folly. If Ka Ray were anywhere, she would not be here. He washed his hands off in the rising water and started to leave the cargo hold.
Goodbye, Sahish, Parker yelled back toward the floating box. I hope you found what you were looking for.
Parker left the hold. 1 o'clock a.m. Parker found himself lost. Panic started to confuse his bearings. He reached for a closed door. He found it locked.
What the hell's going on in here? He screamed. Someone in here? Hey, open the door!
No answer. Parker pounded upon the door again. He could hear movement from the other side.
For the love of God, please! He pleaded.
Parker heard a crashing sound coming from behind. Terror rising in him, he turned to see what it was. Like a living entity, a wall of dark green water advanced through the hall. Light fixtures lost in the water gave the scene a demonic atmosphere. Crossing himself, Parker started to pray. He knew that he was about to die.
Click, click, click.
Parker was shocked to hear someone opening the door behind him. Turning away from the advancing water, he grabbed onto the door, pulling it open with all his might.
Pay no attention to the water, he told himself.
The door opened. Covered with coal dust and soaked to the bone, a fireman gave Parker a curious stare.
What the hell are you doing down here, mate?
Parker blasted past the fireman, knocking him to the floor, turning to close the door behind him.
Damn, the firefighter said, picking himself up. That's gratitude for you. Never mind, Parker yelled.
Gravity had made closing the door harder than opening it. Pressed against the wall, the door wouldn't budge.
Help me with this.
The fireman saw the water approach. He understood. He called several of his men over, getting Parker out of the way.
Let us handle this, sir, he said.
The fireman beat the water by only seconds. The water pressed its way through the door, attacking all. The streams of water reduced themselves down to a few trickles. Surprised at the fact that they weren't all dead, the fireman scooped Parker off the floor and frantically ran away from the bulkhead. The fireman knew that the wall could collapse at any moment.
She's not going to hold for long, boys, the firefighter warned. Where did you find this guy? Asked another crewman. Where do you suppose?
An enormous creaking noise vibrated throughout the hall. The Titanic was sinking deeper and deeper into the Atlantic. Parker and his party managed to escape the rushing water, heading up another deck.
We're dead, Parker shouted. No, we're not, the fireman yelled. I know a shortcut.
The fireman ripped off a protective screen leading to one of the interiors of a smokestack.
Come on, lads, he shouted, instructing each man to enter the shaft. She's going down. We'll climb to the top of the stack and wait for the water to reach us.
Several protests were heard, including Parker's, but the fireman won. Nobody wanted to die.
It's the only thing left open to us, he pleaded.
Another bulkhead collapsed. The advancing water could be seen approaching. One by one, the men entered the duct, grabbing onto a small utility ladder within the stack. Almost being swept out of the duct by the rushing water, Parker followed. Inside the number one funnel, Parker felt as if he were in an oven. Although the engines were shut down, the heat was still rising from the engine rooms below. Parker expected to find himself flying high above the rest of the ship. In reality, he was deep inside the Titanic's extensive body. Parker looked up. The funnel revealed a tiny portion of the clear April night. In the presence of so much destruction, Parker was amazed at the pure beauty of a shining star could still catch his attention. The men hurried up the ladder, hoping to escape the sprays of water pouring in from other flooded decks. The chain of men lingered like bugs crawling up a tree, desperately seeking a dry patch of safety. The Titanic shook with a violent explosion.
"What the hell was that?"
Parker shouted, startled. He and the firemen looked below them, seeing a younger shipmate holding onto the ladder weakly. The explosion knocked a screen from a vent near the lad, hitting him in the face. He was bloodied and could not see.
"Help!"
the shipmate pleaded. He stretched out his arm, mixing it in with the constant stream of black smoke coming through the funnel and exiting out the stack above.
"I can't hold on for much longer."
They noticed that the young man was bleeding from more than just his face. A cut on his right wrist flowed freely.
"Stand fast, son,"
the fireman gave Parker a look pleading.
"We're coming down to help you. Never you fear."
Parker understood. He started back down the ladder, giving the fireman his best assistance. The fireman patted Parker's right shoe in gratitude.
"What was that explosion?"
Parker asked.
"Probably the damn fire in the coal bunker."
The fireman grabbed the side of the ladder, lowering himself past the injured shipmate.
"Bloody thing's been burning since we left England. She's bound to be rather hot."
An explosion once more hit the ship.
"Watch out!"
Parker yelled, covering his face. Another vent screen had been blown free and started its way down the shaft, splashing into the rising water below.
"Engine room's flooded. She hasn't much time left," said the fireman, coughing.
The fireman whipped off his belt, immobilizing the boy's arm.
"Okay, son," he encouraged. "One wrong at a time." "Where do we go from here?" Parker asked. "We wait until the water reaches the stack and then we swim out."
Parker let go of the injured shipmate. All at once, his fear for the water took over.
"Are you crazy?" "What?"
asked the fireman, honestly confused.
"You got a better idea?"
"Yes."
Parker grabbed hold of the bleeding boy, and he and the fireman started pulling the shipmate up the ladder.
"If we do as you propose, the water will pour into this stack like an empty glass." "Never thought about that." "I suggest that we give it a thought."
The fireman pointed to a vent not 8 feet from where they were.
"There. That one leads to E-deck. She hasn't flooded yet."
Parker nodded, agreeing with the fireman's logic. At the most, he figured that the water had only reached the Titanic's name on the outside hull. It would only be a matter of moments before the bow would be totally submerged.
"There's still time. Whatever you do, don't panic," he said.
Parker's mind flashed back to his childhood, watching his mother pleading for help while his father did all that was possible to save their boat. Both parents died, while a helpless boy watched from the dock.
"Keep an eye on the debris, sir,"
the fireman yelled up to Parker. Parker's attention returned to the present, his eyes from time to time gazing down at the dark water below.
"Where will the duct lead to?" Parker asked. "A fan room just off the steward's dressing room. From there we can travel the hall up to the promenade." "Right."
Parker reached the screen, pulling it off.
"Watch out," he yelled, allowing the screen to fall.
Parker investigated the duct. It was dry and appeared to be so on the entire deck. The fireman was correct. E-deck was safe.
"Okay, bring him up," Parker ordered.
The fireman strained as he lifted his shipmate. Within seconds, all the men headed down the vent onto E-deck.
"Hope that there's still some lifeboats left,"
said the fireman as he carried his friend to safety. Parker gave the firefighter a sad look. 1:05 a.m. At the base of the number one funnel, Kare slowly raised her head out of the water, looking up. Seeing three men climbing up a ladder, she felt unusual sensations come over her.
It was he. "Great Anubis, this is the man,"
Kare said with wonder.
"This is the one who praises me above all else."
Ka Ray could feel a leer growing on her face as she kept her eyes on Dennis Parker.
Chapter 15. A-Deck, First Class Promenade, 1:15 a.m. Fifth Officer Harold Lowe shouted orders to his men, keeping a keen eye on the ropes moving through the davits as each lifeboat hit the water, preferably with ease. It had been a hard task to load the boats, more so than the captain realized.
"Please, ladies," Lowe pleaded, noticing that most of the forward lifeboats had already been released and were slowly rowing away from the Titanic. "You cannot pick and choose here. Advance, and we shall see to your safety."
The proud women of the Titanic huffed, smoothing out feathers on their hats, complaining about their lack of sleep, and seeing to it that each senior officer on board got a headache as large as the ship itself. Protests ran rampant as women refused to leave because of the cold, or the lifeboat's number was unlucky, or that they didn't like the company they would have to be keeping. The men on board, however, could see that something was wrong, along the lines of a nightmare. From time to time, Lowe had been stopped in his duties to explain why the decks were tilting. Calmly, the fifth officer persuaded whoever had bothered him to retreat back into the crowd. The men knew their fate. For the first time in their lives, they were actually happy to hear their women complain. Lowe swung out the davits on boat 5, turning to ask for more passengers.
"Come on with you now," the officer cried.
He motioned toward the empty vessel, encouraging anyone to enter. A timid man stepped forward, nervous. He fidgeted with a threadbare brown derby in his hands. Lowe watched his men secure the lines and failed to notice that his first passenger was a man.
"Get on board," Lowe waved, paying more attention to the lifeboat's lines.
The nervous little man, who wasn't a day over 50, happily jumped into the boat. He silently let out a prayer, thankful. He was not safe for long.
"And now," Lowe shouted, noticing the man. "Captain's orders. Women and children only." "I don't want to die. You can't keep me here,"
the nervous man pleaded, grabbing hold of the lifeboat's planking for his life.
"For God's sake, man, at least keep your pride," Lowe said. "Show these women that there might be some hope of survival."
Lowe ordered his men to secure their lines and to pull the man from the lifeboat.
"What are you doing to that man?" someone shouted.
"Following the captain's orders."
"They are?"
Harold Lowe turned to see Bruce Ismay glaring at him. At first, the fifth officer failed to recognize him. Rarely did a man of Lowe's rank get to meet the chairman of the company.
"Mr. Ismay."
"I am," Ismay proclaimed with pride. "I don't like the way you're handling this, sir. Slipshod all the way."
"I'm sorry that you feel that way."
Lowe turned from Ismay. There were more important things to do than to pamper another snob. One by one, the confused women, far against their wishes, kissed their husbands goodbye, lowering themselves into one of the Titanic's lifeboats. From the corner of his eye, Lowe could see that Ismay was fuming. The man was trying to figure out his next course of action. Lowe believed Ismay to be frightened out of his mind.
"Look here, you men," Ismay ordered the linemen. "Watch these boats with your lives. No bumping."
"Step away from the boat, sir," the fifth officer warned.
Ismay gave Lowe a hard stare.
"Who the devil do you think you are, sir?"
"Fifth officer of the Titanic,"
Lowe challenged, having far too much of this man.
"Who are you to be giving me orders? There is only one captain on this ship, sir."
Bruce Ismay's face turned livid with rage.
"You know who I am. I'm..."
Ismay stopped. He started to babble.
I'm a passenger. A passenger."
"Then, sir, if you are a passenger, kindly get away from the work crews and let us do our jobs."
Ismay disappeared into the crowd, lost.
"There'll be talk of this once we reach New York," Lowe heard one of his men saying as they cranked the davits.
The fifth officer watched as another boat readied itself for duty.
"Reach New York. The man's an optimist."
1:20 a.m. The Titanic rocked again from an explosion. Her bow below the water started to give way to the force of gravity calling her to point towards the bottom of the Atlantic. Screams from terrified passengers were heard as the support wires around the number one funnel had given way, snapping like twigs. Within seconds, the funnel dropped from her casing and into the cold, dark water, killing scores of people swimming near the hull. Among them, American millionaire John Jacob Astor. The ship started to list to port heavily. As the panic hit the hundreds on board, the passengers in the lifeboats could just barely make out the emergence of the ship's propellers from the murky water. Shiny red, they looked as if they were covered with blood. A deck, first class smoking room. Dennis Parker entered the smoking room, hearing the cheers of the miserably drunk.
Looks like these men have found the easy way to check out, Parker thought, blinking away a dense cloud of cigar smoke. And why not? If it keeps looking this way, I might join them.
The men from all classes started to sing the remnants of an Irish pub song. Parker's nerves were on edge. So much had happened to him in such a short time. He started to shake violently. Shame flashed through his mind, the shame of facing danger and failing its challenge. He was a man of action. That is what he trained himself to be. In the smoking room of this doomed ship, he was meekly shaking like a child for all other men to see. He was frightened and ashamed.
Dennis, get a hold of yourself, he grunted.
His knees were too weak to hold him. He had to sit down. Parker was beyond exhaustion. Every muscle in his body ached with piercing pain. He stretched his fingers out, noticing that he had cut his hand. A red gash dripped blood onto the Titanic's carpet, showing a trail behind him. He sat next to a young married couple cuddling each other on a sofa next to where a fire was roaring. It was when looking up at a lone man staring into the room's only oil painting hanging above the mantel that Parker realized that he had bumped into his friend, Thomas Andrews.
Thomas? Parker asked.
Andrews turned from the picture to give his friend a blank look. At first, there was no recognition at all coming from the shipbuilder's face. Andrews showed no emotion. After a few seconds, the shipbuilder just returned to his painting, paying no mind to the events unfolding around him. Parker pulled his tie off and wrapped it around the wound on his hand. He felt guilty about the bloodstains he had left on the sofa and the floor and started to wipe the blood with both hands and shoes.
It was all for nothing,
Andrews said, his eyes vacant. Parker stopped scraping the bloodstains with his shoes, surprised to hear something coming from his friend. Andrews had been so alert during the last hour and a half that Parker was sure that his friend would survive. Looking at him, Parker believed him to be in a delayed shock, finally realizing the scope of the disaster's outcome.
What?
Parker asked, joining his friend at the mantle.
What was for nothing? The ship. We flew straight into the face of God, daring him to slap at us.
Andrews let out an ironic laugh, his eyes never leaving the painting above him.
Our science exceeded our humility. We thought that we were so powerful and intelligent that he had to show us otherwise.
Andrews paused, bending to kindle the fire.
I wanted to build a fire before she sank.
Parker studied his friend. He had never seen him so naked and defenseless.
A lovely fire, he agreed. She's my baby, laddie, Andrews cried. I want her to know the warmth of a fire before she dies.
Andrews patted the wood around the mantle as if he were comforting a sick dog. It was as if Andrews could sense the struggles going on through the ship, and like a living being was comforting it in its moment of need. Andrews looked up from his empty stare and noticed the blood dripping from his friend's hand.
Holy Mary, Dennis!
The shipbuilder replaced the fireplace's guard, reaching for Parker's hand. Gently, he grabbed it by the wrist and fingers, examining it as if he were a doctor.
What have you done to yourself? Had no choice, Parker explained. Went below to confront Ka Ray and came in contact with a wall of water. Ever go crawling up the inside of a smokestack? Not much fun. I wouldn't recommend it. Foolish thing to do. I instructed the men to find you, but no one knew where to look.
A flash of guilt crossed Andrew's eyes.
I even tried to stop you.
Parker silently apologized.
My friend, when was the last time I ever took your advice?
Andrew smiled.
When I asked you to sail with me.
Parker turned pale.
Hey, that was my idea, friend. Don't be so hard on yourself. I'm going down with her,
Andrew said. Nervous, he swallowed. I blame myself for this nonsense. It is my fault that these people are going to die.
It is your fault that Ismay was greedy, Parker protested. I'm as guilty as you are.
To that, Andrews gave his friend a curious look.
You? Yes, me, Parker explained. Me and my ambition. I really didn't need to find Kare's body. I had more than enough information on her to write several books on the subject. My ego required the find.
Andrews shook his head, still unable to agree with the events that had happened on the voyage.
Kare did not destroy this ship, he explained. An iceberg did. Are you sure? Parker asked. Curses do work in parts of the world. Magic in some cultures is as real and as powerful as science. Who's to say that magic wasn't the first of the sciences?
The ship's band started to play. Streams of a happy waltz began to echo throughout the smoking room, adding a feeling of glee to the place.
At least the band's still playing, Andrew said.
The men walked over to the smoking room's arched windows, looking out to see several people dancing on the ship's tilting decks. Death was all around, and people were dancing.
Amazing, Parker replied, lost in thought. What's so amazing, my friend? That such beauty can be found on the eve of such horror.
Never underestimate the power of the human spirit, Andrews proclaimed. It's a torch that shines far beyond most earthly evils. Andrews directed Parker's attention to an elderly couple holding hands sitting on a nearby bench and said,
Do you see those two over there?
Yes, Parker said with just a hint of recognition in his voice.
I think I met them during last night's dinner ball. Their name escapes me at the moment.
Mr. and Mrs. Isidore Strauss.
Oh, yes, the department store owner.
Andrews gave his friend a curious look.
How long were you in Egypt not to be hearing of the Strausses?
Parker was embarrassed. It had been a long time.
I don't shop much.
Mr. Strauss happens to be a co-owner of Macy's, Andrews pointed out, one of the largest stores in the world. Parker raised his hand, surrendering.
They have decided to go down together. Imagine that. Thomas, you need to survive.
Why?
Andrews questioned carefully.
There will be mysteries that only you will be able to answer. Only you will be able to point the fingers at the guilty.
Andrews gave his friend's logic some thought.
Perhaps. Your suggestion carries with it serious merit.
Parker placed his injured hand on his friend's shoulder. He failed to see that the dressing was coming off his injury. The hand started to bleed again. Andrews returned to the mantle, staring into the oil painting above.
Thomas, what are you doing?
Admiring the artwork.
Parker pointed to the hundreds of people running up and down the decks, their cries of panic barely being heard above the ship's collapsing walls.
Tom, there are people out there who could use your help. If it's art you wish to admire, I know of a few museums in New York.
Andrews didn't move.
Think of your family, man, Parker pleaded. What of them?
Parker's friend was mentally lost in a make-believe world where his great ship was still sailing on to her destination, a destination she would never reach.
Thomas, Parker cried, knowing that his friend was lost. Please.
Andrews would not move. Parker had no choice. He left his friend to his fate. Andrews heard the doors shut behind him. He turned from the painting to notice the couple sitting on a nearby couch. They had been witness to all, and were staring at Andrews with curious eyes.
Hello, my friends, Andrews said with a smile.
The couple acknowledged their greeter with a smile and a nod. Quite young, they appeared to be of British descent. The young woman was holding the man's hand tightly, so firmly that all the man's blood was slowly leaving his flesh. Scared, both were willing to face their fates together, knowing the uncertain outcome.
There are still a few boats left, Andrew suggested. Both of you could survive.
We've decided to stay a while, the woman said, looking into her husband's eyes.
I see, Andrew said. If you decide differently, I suggest that you climb down one of the ropes and gently float away from the ship. Wear something warm and brightly colored.
The man got nervous and made to leave. The woman waved at Andrews as both departed to enjoy the music outside. Would they survive? Andrews sincerely hoped so. He stood alone in the first-class smoking room, staring at the picture, hearing the slow creaks of his ship.
The expansion joints are starting to give way. It won't be much longer, I fear.
New York would have been excellent, Andrews regretfully said. He returned to the warmth of the fire, adding a log to the flames. Chapter 16. A Deck, First Class Promenade, 2 o'clock a.m. Reginald Kotz completed the task of helping a Titanic officer turn out a davit and heard the sounds of a child crying.
"Here, here," he said, looking at the child. "What's all this that I'm hearing?"
The child brought Kotz's attention toward a lifeboat starting to drift away from the ship. On board, among the many freezing passengers, Kotz could barely make out the face of a young woman screaming for her child.
"Dear me," Kotz said, trying to hold back the panic growing in his eyes. "Your mother must be quite worried to be yelling for you like that."
"I missed the boat," the child explained innocently.
"I should say that you did."
Confused, she began to cry. Kotz fumbled with his hands. He could look at a murder scene and study a dead body. He could scan an endless line of criminal statistics and discover a reasonable clue. He could traverse miles to capture a wanted felon. But he knew nothing about the needs of a child's heart. As she cried, the detective turned to his colleagues at the davits and gave them a serious stare. The Titanic crewmen stopped their work, showing concern for the child's welfare. More than one in the group connected the crying girl on the promenade with the screaming mother in the lifeboat below. Lost, Kotz placed his hands in his coat pockets, another habit that helped him to think clearly.
"Hey."
Kotz smiled, taking his flute out of his pocket.
"How about a little music while we wait for the next boat?"
The child stopped her crying.
"Will my mother be able to hear?"
"Of course, my love."
Kotz's heart started to swell.
"I'll play it so loud that even the angels shall hear."
"Oh, I do so much like angels," she clapped.
"Go on, Gov," a Titanic crew member coached. "It won't be much longer. She'll be all right. You've got my word on that."
Kotz placed his fingers accordingly across the many holes of his flute. It was a cherished item, given to him long ago by a prince of Scotland when he solved a mystery involving the Loch Ness Monster. He so loved the flute that it was really the only object from his old life he was taking with him to the new world. Musical notes came flying out. Kotz could be heard playing from almost every corner of the ship. At one point, he noticed Captain Smith looking on from the port bridge wing as he played. The band nearby stopped to listen as well, then joined in. The detective knew not why he chose to play the song he did, but he played it with all of his heart. Tear-filled eyes played the violin, trumpet, and piano as all on board began to sing. "Nearer, my God, to thee, nearer to thee. E'en though it be a cross that raiseth me, still all my song shall be nearer, my God, to thee, nearer to thee." For an instant, all time seemed to stop. The ship turned hauntingly quiet. With hands shaking, Kotz removed his fingers from his flute. Never had he heard it play with such clarity. Although he was not a betting man, he was sure that if a man were standing on a New York dock, he could hear a faint musical note drifting his way. Claps and amens came from all around. Smith was seen looking from his bridge with tears in his eyes.
"Another," the child ordered. "This time make it a happy one."
The lifeboat next to Kotz and the child slowly lowered into place. There would be no more time for songs.
"Perhaps when we reach New York, pumpkin," Kotz winked.
Before the child could express her disappointment, she was snatched up by one of the crew and placed into a boat.
"She'll be looked after," one of them was heard saying.
Kotz waved goodbye, saying a silent prayer for the child's safe recovery. Below, in the water, a mother's crying suddenly stopped. Kotz waved at the young woman. She shouted blessings up to him for looking after her daughter.
"Excuse me, sir,"
a voice came from the crowd. Kotz turned to see the band leader looking at him with interest.
Can I help you? Kotz asked. My name's Wallace Hartley, the young man said. He made a respectful bow, causing Kotz some alarm. Would you, by any chance, be a musician by trade? No, I'm a retired criminal investigator. The band members responded with surprise. You're playing, Hartley exclaimed. It was beautiful. Merely a hobby to pass the time.
The dashing young band leader gave his detective friend a critical look.
At the moment, Hartley said, it appears as if we have nothing better to do. What's your point? We'd be honored if you'd join us in our playing.
Kotz gave it some thought.
Delighted.
Hartley and his men clapped their hands with praise.
Well done, sir, one of the band members was heard to say.
As the Titanic sank deeper and deeper into the Atlantic, and as the last wireless distress signal was sent, and as the last of the lifeboats was lowered, Kotz played his part in a version of Songe d'automne, a waltz. A deck, first class smoking room, 2:20 a.m. Thomas Andrews poured himself a drink. His thoughts were drifting back to his wife. She would take his death hard, and he knew it. Living with pain was better than living with the shame of association. Andrews gulped the whiskey and winced at its sour aftertaste. Nearby, a card game was breaking up.
I say, it's every man for himself, Andrews heard one of the card players say. Something is dreadfully wrong with this ship, and I will play no more.
Andrews turned from the bar with a bottle in hand, watching the group of men as they exited the room. Surprisingly, he found himself crying. For most of the voyage, the men playing cards in the ship's smoking room had been a daily routine. Passengers, curious of the game, would walk by and receive a respectful silence to any question asked. They would just continue slapping cards on the table. Their leaving was a final testament to the Titanic's safety.
Funny that it took a sinking to interrupt their game, Andrews remarked, remembering the events leading up to the ship's scandalous Sunday card game.
As Sunday approached, Andrews had been aware of the fact that the captain himself was going to put a stop to the gambling. But upon learning that one of the game's contestants was the personal aide to President Taft, the order was never carried out.
Let them play, the captain said. We need no trouble from the American president.
Andrews raised his glass and toasted the men as they joined the panic outside. He shouted,
Here's to you, you men. I hope the stakes were worth it.
Andrews walked over to the fireplace, staring back into the natural pigments of the oil painting above.
Give my regards to Broadway, Andrews said bitterly, drinking what was left of the whiskey.
Angry, he threw the empty bottle at the painting, watching as the glass shattered all around. He heard a movement from behind. It was not the familiar sound of furniture sliding across the floor, hitting the opposite wall of the room. It was not the popping sound of stress on an expansion joint. Nor was it the rumble of a huge engine breaking loose below decks. Andrews was no longer alone. Drunk, he found his heart beating faster than it normally would. The tilting floor was making it practically impossible for him to stand. The sudden turning of his body to see who was standing behind him was too much for him. He began to lose his balance, tipping several times as he tried to regain a foothold.
Dennis, Andrews said, falling to his knees. Is that you? I'm not leaving, no matter what you say or do. Do you hear me?
There was no response. Andrews looked up, staring into Ka Ray's dead eyes.
Upon my mother's soul, Andrews gasped in horror. It is herself.
Ka Ray stepped forward, giving the Irishman a curious look. Slowly, Andrews made it to his feet.
Why?
He shouted, meaning the sinking of the ship. Ka Ray didn't respond. Instead, she looked around the smoking room as if to appreciate the ship's beauty.
Enjoy it while you can, Andrews shouted with drunken rage. For in less than an hour, it will all be at the bottom of the sea. I built this ship, Andrews yelled. I deserve an answer.
Mockingly, Ka Ray gave Andrews a respectful bow. He studied the mummy. Although rotted, smelling of death and silent, she had all the markings of having once been a beautiful woman. Her tight wrappings, ancient and brittle with age, showed a shapely body underneath. Kare seemed to sense Andrew's fascination. Her body started to shake. She was laughing silently.
"What's so damn funny?" Andrews demanded.
The Titanic shook violently.